From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, June 5th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunathchish, Hawa, Toaksuknusum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Facebook and Instagram pages. Get a behind-the-scenes look into the studio. Today, we talk with author Larry Irene Spengler about her book, Taking Time, Sailing with My Family in Southeast Alaska, ahead of her first Friday book signing. Tomorrow, June 6th, commemorates the 125th anniversary of the Alaska State Museum, and Steve Henriksen is here to share more about a special talk and celebration happening at noon on Friday. And UAS Chancellor Dr. Aparna Palmer is here to talk summer UAS activities and the alumni barbecue happening this weekend. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. You can also join us for a behind-the-scenes, in-the-studio look on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages, a live video stream. Hearthside Bookstore celebrates First Friday with a book signing from author Larry Irene Spengler, tomorrow from 4:30 to 7 p.m. in the downtown location in the Wharf. Her book, Taking Time, Sailing with My Family in Southeast Alaska, is about learning to live in the present moment and nurturing family bonds. Larry joins me in studio now. Gunathchish, Ha'igudi. It's such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Larry, Wasiati, how are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. That's so good. And it's what a pleasure to have an author that lives here in Juno that's having a book come out.
A very excited author.
Yeah, sure. How is that? What is it? Is this your first book?
This is my first book. I was a lawyer in my earlier life, so I've done a lot of writing. But
okay.
This is my first book, and we sailed for 18 years in our sailboat out of Juno.
Yeah.
Our family did, and this is a distillation of that. It's, if I hadn't done it for any other reason, it's so my husband and daughter and I would have a way of remembering what those 18 years were like. And
a document, so, as you were.
Exactly.
That's so cool. Well, let's talk about you first, and then we'll get to the book. But so tell me about your background. I know you grew up in the interior in Delta Junction.
That's okay. Right. Far from any ocean.
Far from any ocean. So sailing was like a new proposition for you when you got to it, or was it something you picked up when you moved down here to Juneau?
One of my favorite children's books growing up was about some children who sailed a small boat on the English, in the Lake District of England. And then when I was in California, I took a few sailing lessons. So I, ever since having read those books, I really was interested in sailing. But it was when we got to Juneau and my husband decided we needed a bigger boat than a skiff to basically broaden our horizons, and we got the sailboat. That was a first for all of us.
That's awesome. Now, you mentioned that you were a lawyer, and you worked in what areas of law did you work?
Natural resources. I worked most of my career for the Attorney General's office doing fish and game, natural resources, and environmental conservation law.
I see. Okay.
And then after our daughter was born, I took 5 years off, and then I started doing contract work for other lawyers, mostly in fisheries stuff still. That was my area.
So you're used to the outdoors and talking about it and...
Yeah.
Yeah, and then is it something you still do, or are you retired from lawyering?
Oh, I'm retired from lawyering.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So now this book, one of the concepts in there that I want to talk about, which I thought was really cool, and it's actually something you mentioned that you learned while growing up, which was this the value of space to do nothing. Now, this is something I need in my life, Larry. So tell me some of the lessons that you've learned about the value of doing nothing.
I believe that plenty of time, plenty of unstructured time is what allows us to be fully engaged the other parts of our time.
Mm.
And as my husband and I had our children, and my husband has two boys, and then we have Megan, our daughter, one of our prime considerations was making sure they had enough time that wasn't structured. I mean, there is so much to do in Juneau with kids.
Mm.
But it's really important to not have every minute filled with lessons and team sports, at least in my view. And when we got the sailboat, that was a perfect way for us to, well, take time. One of the meanings of the title, Take Time, is to take time away from regular life and get out, no matter how, whether it was an afternoon trip, an overnight, a couple of days, or a two-week trip, we came back so restored and refreshed as individuals and also as a family unit. It was, but you don't need a sailboat to do that. Go from, you know, Juneau has the Forest Service cabins, and you can go for hikes, and you can go out in a skiff. I mean, just to get away from emails and news alerts and the headlines and just the calls of modern life is very restorative.
I feel that way. I mean, I have my daughter's now 24, almost mm-hmm. 24, and I did feel that when she was growing up, was like how to sort of disconnect a little bit, because you can. I feel like I see some kids and they're after school, they go right to some after school activity and then to another thing, and then they have to do their homework, and then they might have another practice of some sort, and then they have to go to sleep, and you're still a kid. And I always think about it for kids, but then I'm also like, for grown-ups, we also need that time. I spent, you know, a lifetime in the theater, and so I would have a regular job, and then I'd go spend nights and weekends in the darkened theater. And, you know, nowadays, I value that time. That I was like, wow, I didn't even know what I was missing, really, with being able to just have a weekend and not do anything and not fill it up with activities.
Yes. There are so many valuable activities. It's just, it seems to me foolish to try to do them all at once.
You just can't. Yeah, there's too many things. I mean, I've also thought about this, you know, like I would love to have been a lawyer. I would love to have done this other thing. There's so many things you could do in life, but you choose a path and you have to figure out what that is. And you can sort of admire those people who are doing the thing that maybe you wanted to do, but you chose to
a
do
different
something
path.
Different.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm curious, like, what was the impetus for you to take up writing this book, Taking Time?
It was a dual impetus, I guess. One is we have four handwritten logs from our 18 years, and they're not searchable by computer, of course.
Mm.
And I wanted us meaning my husband, my daughter, and I, who are the ones who are on the boat mostly, to be able to easily slip back into the experience of being away on our boat.
Mm.
And so that was one of them, is to put it in. The book is written episodically. It's not chronological. So there's a chapter on boat food and a chapter on peculiar adventures. I mean, it starts at the beginning and it ends at the end, but otherwise it's so we can go back and relive all that through this much more easily than flipping the pages of the log trying to find what was that happened.
Mm.
And then the other strand was just what you're saying, is I thought there was some lesson that we got such value from stepping away from our daily life, and it didn't have to be very long. And it was, I felt like if it was in a book that wasn't just for our family, it was for other people, that would be an impetus maybe for them to get a Forest Service cabin if they weren't, or turn off their internet for the weekend or whatever.
Just, I like that, because not everybody can afford a sailboat, obviously, but there's other ways to sort of, so it's really about sort of disconnecting.
Right.
And being with, because you also talked about how this, it really brought your family closer together because you're all sharing in this journey. You probably all have jobs on the sailboat that you have to do to make it happen. And whether it's an afternoon or a weekend or a week long. What was the longest you took on the sailboat?
The longest we did was 2 weeks.
Two weeks.
And most of our, it started off, the first summer we had her, we only did afternoon sails because we were learning how to sail. Mm. We didn't really know how to do this. And we did one overnight. And then the next year we added in a whole cluster of one or two night overnight trips. Mm. And then the trips got fewer but longer. If you see what I
mean. Okay, yeah.
So if we went for 2 weeks, then we would be home for a while. We wouldn't be going out every fourth afternoon in the
right,
boat. So.
Right. And you said you have a chapter on, I'm sure there's lessons you've learned as you, 18 years, mm-hmm. you gain some experience. So you have a chapter on boat food. And is it something that, like, when you started out, you thought you could have full prepared meals, or what did you end up learning about boat food?
No,
or what are the tips?
We always went with simple.
Simple.
We were totally into simple. There are people who have fancier boats than we did that have ovens. And when we would be anchored up with them and we would go to their house, we were like agog when they would take the brownies out of the oven.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important lessons we learned was how to work together in a situation that didn't allow for consensus decision making.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I have a half a page that I can read if that's
oh,
okay.
Oh, please, I would
that
love
would
that.
Be it's the very first half page of the book.
And it's on consensus making.
Well, okay. It's called The Family That Sails Together Needs a New Protocol.
Okay, let's hear it.
Mama, he's not listening. 12-year-old Megan was almost weeping with frustration. My husband, Steve, was gripping the tiller, appeared fully focused on his steering, and certainly showed no sign that he had heard her warning, repeated several times, each time louder and more urgently, that he needed to adjust our heading or we would jibe. I was not even sure what jibing was, but Megan obviously and intensely wanted us to avoid it. Steve, did you hear Megan? If you did, you need to acknowledge it. I tried again to break into his concentration. Do you think she's right about jibing? He glanced at me. Sorry? What? I need to pay attention to these boats about to cross in front of us. Dad, you either need to let the sail out or turn to port now, immediately. Steve started to push the tiller to the left, and Megan lunged for it, pulling it to the right. He looked angry. She looked furious. The horizontal metal boom did not endanger our heads by precipitously flying across to the opposite side in an accidental jibe. The boats crossed in front of us without incident, and we all relapsed into tense and unhappy silence. We had just started sailing, and so far, sailing was not always going well for us. And what we eventually figured out was our family had virtually always made decisions by consensus. We would talk things through. We're all reasonable human beings, and we would find out which. But when you're on a boat moving, you can't do that. You have to. The person who's ever at the tiller has to make the call, and everybody else has to give them information. And we have to trust each other. But we had no basis for trusting each other because none of us knew what we were doing. So it was a huge we actually wrote out a protocol, which is in the chapter about how we'll try to do this better once we realized what was the matter. So it was good expanding our family communication skills and experiences of being intra family, I guess, decision making in an area that we hadn't ever had to deal with before, which was we couldn't talk it all out.
That's so great. I'm talking with Larry Spengler about her book, Taking Time Sailing with My Family in Southeast Alaska, here on Juno Afternoon. She has a first Friday book signing at 4:30 to 7 at Hearthside Books downtown. You'll be there to sign the books. And this you mentioned right before we went on air that maybe it's been on Amazon, but this is the first time it's going to be appearing physically in form tomorrow at Hearthside.
That's right. This is it. It's a book signing, but in a sense, it's a book launch for Juno too, because it hasn't been here yet.
So. That's so great.
Yeah.
And I must feel. How does that feel? It must feel amazing.
I feel so pleased. I feel so pleased with my patience in the process. I took the words out of the title, Taking Time. I just took the time that it took, and I had a lot of other things going on in my life, so I couldn't just sit down and write it. So I started it in January 2019, and
okay.
So I got it finished somewhere along the way, and then our family came to the very hard decision that it was time to sell the boat.
Oh.
Because Megan was now in her 30s. She has a job at the university. She's not living at home anymore. Steve is fully engaged in renewable energy stuff in Juneau. I'm doing a bunch of other things. We just didn't have the time. So we decided, with many tears and sadness and wistful remembrances, that we were going to sell the boat. And then I had to go back through the whole manuscript and change the verb tenses. Because it didn't seem right to me not to say in the book that that's what happened in the end.
Right.
So then I couldn't say, every day for breakfast, we have X. I had to change it to, every day for breakfast on the boat, we had X. And those were hard to catch, because not all of them were changed. Because if you want to say Tracy Arm is south of Juneau, it still is south of Juneau. I didn't have to change that tense. So it was complicated.
That's where I guess an editor comes in and helps it. I guess the question too is, as a local Juneau writer, I'm always curious, like, how did you find a publisher? How did you get this book out there into the world?
I had several friends and acquaintances in Juneau who had published with Cirque Press, which is called a hybrid press. So the author has a lot of control, but the press also has control, and they don't just take everything that's submitted. And I submitted it to them, and they specialize in Pacific Northwest and some Canadian over to Hawaii authors. And after they went through it, they decided they would publish it. And so then there we went. That was a whole long process of its own. So
Right. Yeah, because that's a big deal. I've heard Cirque Publishing before. I think we've had some other authors on who've been there. So that's a good one. If somebody's out there and has an idea, or however that goes, did you have the whole manuscript done when you submitted to them?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I did. And it was as done as I could make it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the editor there made some small suggestions, and one really good suggestion that involved changing the writing around a bit. But I had it. I don't actually know if they would take just the germ of an idea and nurture you along, because my situation was that it was
done, and you submitted it as a done manuscript, and then had some changes, but otherwise it was pretty much complete. What a great story! What a wonderful adventure! It is a sad thing to not have the boat anymore, I guess, but this is one reason that you have this document.
That's right.
And I guess last question for you: what do you hope that readers who don't have a boat or wouldn't maybe have this ability to have a boat take away from reading this book?
I believe with a boat, with an RV, with a Forest Service cabin, just I think it's so important to very deliberately, intentionally disconnect. Even staying home and shutting off the internet and pretending you're not home, you know, for 2 days. Just disconnect and be together. Read to each other, read to yourselves, spend time. That would be a family. Individuals, you don't have to read to each other because you are one individual. But I can't overstate how excellent that was for our family dynamic and the health, the overall health of our family. So
yeah, I love that. And I love the concept of family time. I love the concept of do nothing, right? Take a break.
Yeah.
Turn that darn phone off, right? Because that is the thing that gets us all a little bit. When we have nothing to do, we stand in line, we don't take a moment just to be with ourselves. We flip that phone out and start scrolling.
That's right.
So this is great. It's Taking Time, Larry Irene Spengler. It is First Friday book signing tomorrow from 4:30 to 7 at Hearthside Books downtown. And where can we follow you for more adventures, Larry? Do you have a website or an Instagram?
I do not. I'm disconnected pretty much. I have a Facebook page.
You have a Facebook page. Okay.
Well, but it's just mine. I mean, it's not me as an author.
Live by example.
Thank you.
I love that.
That's right. Thanks
for being here
Thank
today.
Thank you so much.
This is Juneau Afternoon from KTOO. Here's a little Sounds Wild.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years. With cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Sounds Wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
On a drizzly July day in 2022, a pair of researchers with the Sitka Tribe of Alaska are digging butter clams on a beach near Juneau. Butter clams are good, but they won't be eating these clams. In fact, they know these clams are dangerous. they have high levels of the toxins that cause paralytic shellfish poisoning. Researchers are gathering these clams to better understand how these naturally occurring toxins accumulate in shellfish. The toxins don't hurt the clams, but they can kill birds, animals, and people that eat them. The toxins, a variety that affect the nervous system, known as saxitoxins, are produced by blooms of planktonic algae, which accumulate in filter feeders like clams and mussels. Different species of shellfish absorb and retain the toxins differently, some with extremely high concentrations. Researchers found butter clams retain their algae toxins much longer than do other shellfish, like blue mussels. Blue mussels spike quickly at high levels, but then the levels drop. Over a matter of weeks, butter clams can retain toxins for a year or more. In fact, the Latin name for butter clams is Saxidomus, the origin of the name saxitoxin. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. On June 6, 1900, through an act of Congress, the Historical Library and Museum for the District of Alaska was created. It celebrates 125th birthday tomorrow, and at noon, the Alaska State Museum Curator of Collections, Steve Henriksen, will be giving a special presentation followed by some birthday cake to honor the occasion. And Steve joins me now. Gwyneth Chi, Sha'i Gudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you in today, Steve. How are you? Yeah, wasa iati. So, 125 years.
Yeah, it's one of the oldest surviving agencies in what is now the state government that has more or less lasted that entire time. 125 years is ancient history in Alaska as far as the United States government. And at the time we were created, the governor of Alaska was appointed by the president, and that's why it took an act of Congress to set up what is now the Alaska State Library and Alaska State Museum.
So... why was it created?
Well, that's a really good question, because at the time, Alaska didn't have much of anything. They had dilapidated Russian buildings left over from 1867 when the Russians left. There was very little infrastructure around that was much use, and there were so many things that were lacking. They had little money. The federal government really hadn't invested in Alaska yet. And so it always was curious to me why they would take the time to start thinking about a library and museum. But I think Governor Brady, John Brady, was really interested in Alaska history. And he first came to Alaska as a missionary and worked with Alaska Native cultures, especially the Tlingit and Haida people. And I think he really developed an appreciation for the culture and saw something in Alaska's history and cultures that was really fascinating. The mix that took place, that Alaska was really the crossroads of continents between Asia and North America. People have been going back and forth across the Bering Strait for thousands of years, and I think he really thought that was interesting and significant in world history. Plus, he was all about economic development along with resource extraction. He was looking for ways to promote investment and population to come into Alaska, and he thought that things like totem poles were the perfect topic to draw people's attention. And that's why around the same time he created the museum, he started working on a big display for the World's Fair in St. Louis in 1904. He actually took down there about two dozen Tlingit and Haida totem poles and put them up on the banks of the Mississippi River for the summer down in Mississippi as a way to attract attention. And he had a big building there where he built displays showing Alaskan resources and products that would hopefully attract investors. Then the following year, there was another World's Fair in Portland, Oregon. So he shipped the whole thing up to Portland and spent the summer there. And then after that was done, he shipped the totem poles and artifacts and other things back to Alaska. And he created the Totem Park in Sitka. That's where the totem poles ended up. The artifacts, though, that became the nucleus of the Alaska State Museum and Library.
Interesting. Okay, because I know, like, Anchorage wasn't even really a town. Like, it wasn't even a thought, really, at that point yet, not really. And so just in terms of the size of where the state was, I'm also curious about, you know, we're more aware today of how things were acquired, maybe legally, not legally, or taken from, you know, the tribes and the Alaska Native peoples in terms of that. And is there any history of that with the Alaska State Museum and in those early days of how they were acquiring things? And has there been, you know, conversations with like Tlingit and Haida in terms of, because I know you have a lot of items at the museum that are of historical relevance and
right.
also are relevant to the clans and the tribes. And so I'm just curious what that history is.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately in the early years, they didn't really document their the procurement, so to speak, of things for the collection.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot to go on. We've had to reconstruct a lot of that, and some of it's based on consultations with tribes
mm-hmm.
and other things we can ferret out of the archives and kind of put things back together again to a point. But it's really pretty speculative as far as knowing exactly what they did. And I think a lot of the items that we have were donated by just regular residents of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really know how they acquired them, except in rare circumstances, they'll send a letter with the artifact that they're donating, and it'll say a little bit about where they got it or what the circumstances were. There are some things that we know were taken from graves, and we have those designated, and those are all subject to repatriation under the repatriation law.
Right. Yeah. So you're in conversations with like Tlingit and Haida and Sea Alaska and different organizations about how
yeah.
that might work.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a federal law that outlines what the procedure is,
mm-hmm.
and we're hoping to start consultations with a lot of the tribes that we haven't yet made contact with. There's over 200 federally recognized tribes, and we need to consult with all of them, so it's
wow.
a pretty tall order.
Yeah, it's a big business. Now, I know also that when the museum was founded, that it didn't really have a home. It didn't have like the first 20 years, it was sort of a floating museum.
that's right. It's hard to get money to house a collection that doesn't yet exist. I always think of it as before you can get money, you have to create a big mess. I hate to put it that way, but
yeah.
that's sort of how it works. You have to have a crisis to get adequate funding for doing some of this kind of work. But to start out with, it was they just took the things that were kicking around in the governor's office and closet, things that had been given to the governor over the years, things that were just there, and that was the start of it. And they added to it little by little over the years. They had the World's Fair material coming back that they drew from. They started getting donations for the museum collection, even though they didn't really have a museum yet. They just put it in the closet for the future in hopes that they would have a home for it. And
mm-hmm.
it actually took about almost 20 years before they were able to open a display to the public and a library. That was here in Juneau in the Arctic Brotherhood building that used to be just down the hill from the state office building.
Oh, yeah, so that was its first home was the Arctic Brotherhood.
That's the first,
or
first
display
public
area.
Display, yeah.
Okay, public display.
Before that, it was just in the governor's house. And, in fact, the current governor's house, the third floor of that was supposed to be the home for the museum. It even says on the blueprints
that
was for the Alaska Museum collection. But it would be a really difficult thing to have tourists going up the inside stairs of the governor's house and make their way to the third floor. So they never, as far as I can tell, they never had exhibits up there.
Well, it's so fascinating because anybody who has recently moved to Juneau or is just touring Juneau sees this awesome, you know, library, archives, and museum building that was built. And when was that finalized? When was this building? I know it was constructed over a couple years.
Yeah, it was opened to the public in 2016.
2016, yeah. Okay.
In the building that it replaced, the Alaska Centennial Museum, they called it, was put up in 1968 is when it opened. So it was almost 50 years old. And
oh, wow.
Showing its age, when we would show up to work in the morning, we never knew what we were going to find as far as water standing on the floor in the basement. But we luckily were able to have a state-of-the-art building put up that will hopefully last us another 100 years.
Yeah, I'm sure the deferred maintenance on the 1968 building was never that fun. It's a beautiful building, and it's a lovely location. So tomorrow, you're going to be giving a talk. I'm talking with Steve Hendrickson, who's the curator of collections over the Alaska State Museum. It's its 125th birthday tomorrow, and I'm assuming you're going to be at noon in the room downstairs.
The lecture hall. Just off the atrium.
Off the atrium there, and your talk is going to cover the history.
Yes, of the museum and library, just showing images of the different homes that we've had over the years and some of the people and artifacts that have come into the museum over the years that have interesting backstories. It's the kind of thing I have in my program, the kinds of information that we never have room to put on the labels, kind of the way things came into the museum, sometimes funny, sometimes amazing coincidences. It's just really quite interesting, the different stories that I can tell about how the collection came into being.
I was once very lucky to have Ellen Carley give me a tour of the downstairs and the drawers and just like how much stuff isn't on display, right? Like there's so many things that don't make it upstairs. I mean, I know you try to cycle them through. Obviously, some of them are really delicate and need more work and that kind of thing. But how much is downstairs that we don't see upstairs?
Yeah, well, I think the standard thing that we say, I don't know exactly the percentage, but it's something like 5 to 7% of what's in the collection is on exhibit.
5 to 7%. Wow.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it doesn't make sense to have everything because there's certain types of things that are really too fragile to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Other things are kind of redundant. We're trying to tell the whole story of Alaska.
I see, right.
And we have to reserve room to make room for things like that. All the detail, and there's plenty of things that we don't have represented in the collection that I have a list of the kinds of items that we need to be able to have a well-rounded exhibit in the future. And there's some kinds of things like aviation we don't handle well. We just don't have the space to have full-size aircraft.
Right.
And that's a big part of the Alaskan story of the 20th century, at least. So we'd like to have more material that relates to aviation. And there's always something that we could add. But we're really into what is uniquely Alaskan, trying to define what makes Alaska different from anywhere else on Earth and try to highlight those things.
Well, it's 125 years, which is pretty amazing. And I hope it continues for at least 125 more, as they say.
Yes.
And is there other celebrations that will be happening past tomorrow?
You know, I can't think of any off the top of my head. We are going to have a birthday cake that the Friends of the Museum are providing for after the lecture.
Okay.
So that gives you a little additional incentive to come.
Yeah, you got some food, some free food, some birthday cake. That's right. So it's Friday, June 6th from 12 to 1 p.m. It's at the APK Lecture Hall. It's the special 125th Library Archives and Museum Anniversary Talk with Steve Henriksen, who is the curator of collections over at the Alaska State Museum. It's happening tomorrow. It's what a wonderful thing to have happen. I really appreciate you coming in and telling us about it, and see if people can pop by at noon. Is it going to be recorded?
Yes, we are going to record it and have it on our website for after.
Okay, good. And, of course, you can always go to lam.alaska.gov, which will get you to the Library, Archives, and Museum website. Steve, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Okay, up next, it's this week's issue or episode of Our Living Lands from Native Voice One. This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The West is known for its spectacular outdoor recreation, but for Indigenous communities, access to activities like fly fishing has been difficult. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Tristan Chi, a Navajo filmmaker, about his new film documenting One Camp's work to change that.
Can you share a little bit about your film Rooted Waters and what inspired you to document the Indigenous and Hispanic youth fly fishing camp?
I myself grew up on the Navajo Reservation. I was in an area where water access was very limited. We had one close lake that was nearby, and you know, just grew up fishing with regular spin rods. But fly fishing was never that everyday activity that I didn't grow up with. So being able to be a part of this community here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, really led me to other people who are doing really great work, other leaders who are doing really great work in their area. And one of those was Indigenous and Hispanic Youth Fly Fishing Camp, which is led by another great leader from Santa Clara Pueblo, Vidal Gonzalez. That's how it all started, was, you know, for the community, by the community, and by someone who is of that community. And that's really the main reason why the story came about.
And so Rooted Waters showcases stunning footage of New Mexico's trout streams. What were some of the challenges and rewards of capturing these natural landscapes on film?
You know, the fly fishing film was primarily around the resources of water and where trout basically can live and adapt to. So we have been fishing these areas for, you know, quite a long time, and especially the Pueblo people. So the way that I like to lead my storytelling is to know that these areas are ancestral homelands to a local tribe, and reaching out to the tribe and knowledge keepers there about areas that are special and sacred, and that should not be on film. And the physical filming of it was, you know, using cinematic grade cameras and drone footage, carrying gear in and out of these places. Sometimes the place we would hike into would be about, you know, a mile and a half long, and they would be easily about, you know, 1,000 foot elevation drop within that mile and gain up in that area. So it was pretty difficult, but it was also very fun.
What environmental shifts or climate-related changes did you observe while filming, you know, along the streams and the rivers in New Mexico?
When we were out there, we did see quite a lot, heard a lot, and felt a lot in our senses. And the biggest thing was pretty much the heat. The heat was, you know, super hot in moments where it should not have been. The waters are, you know, not the way they used to be. The levels aren't the way they used to be. And the trout aren't really in the areas where they used to be as well. But we were still, you know, catching them. There is still water out here, which is we're grateful for. And trees are still here. It really instills that conservation mindset into these kids and into ourselves of, you know, we need to protect these landscapes more than the way we have been.
How do you see fly fishing and outdoor education as tools for building climate resilience and environmental awareness among Indigenous and Latino youth?
Yeah. So amongst our communities, we, you know, don't really have a lot of accessibility to the outdoors. And I think the thing about this camp and what it provides is that it really provides knowledge, cultural and traditional knowledge of generations. And the camp also includes elders of these communities to come out to speak on traditional and cultural knowledge of these places we're fishing at, and to, you know, talk about how important it is to take care of Mother Earth, how important it is to take care of the things around you and treat things with respect, and also, you know, give offerings, because what we're doing there is, you know, we're extracting, we're in their environment, and, you know, we've got to leave it better than the way we left it.
What role do you believe storytelling, you know, especially through film, can play in advancing climate action and preserving sacred waters for future generations?
The thing about this is that storytelling and filmmaking go, you know, they coincide, they work together. And to make a really great story is to have someone and something connected in that relation who are wanting to protect, wanting to build something in order to protect, in order to thrive, in order to be resilient.
That was Tristan Chi, director of Rooted Waters, which premiered on May 23rd, 2025 at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Art Living Lands, a collaboration of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. KTO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from Tlingit-Ani and the homelands of the Akwan. The specific area where our building sits is the ancestral home of the Klenedi, or Dog Salmon people of the Akwan. We acknowledge those families of the Klenedi who made use of this land and waterway for thousands of years and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. Gunathchish.
Pocket to spend it right. Baby knows when to make the scene, when to order, when to leave. She says, I'm E4, hazel eyes, wait around for my rock and roll man. Lines are drawn, hair upright, pat on my nose and I'm off like a bandit. Baby blues keeping out the light. In the shadow she's catching eyes. Every charmer takes their chance, shuts it down with a crooked glance. She says, I'm here for hazel eyes, wait around for my rock and roll man. Lines are cast, morning light, hopes are high but they'll wake up stranded. Some need off by staying home.
That's a little Blackwater Railroad Company coming down tomorrow night at the Crystal Saloon. They'll be on the show tomorrow to talk about that album and their statewide tour that they're on right now. That's Blackwater Railroad. You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. I'm joined now in the studio by Dr. Aparna Palmer, Chancellor for the University of Alaska Southeast, for a lovely check-in on everything that's been going on. Gunathchish, Wasiiti. How are you, Dr. Palmer?
Good. Thank you. Gunathchish. I really appreciate being here, as always.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on, and I feel like sometimes people think, like, you know, summer is here, which means we don't think about university, but there's never a slowdown over at the university, is there?
I can see why people see it that way, and certainly there are some areas that are quiet.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, this summer our headcount is up 20%.
Oh wow!
And our credit hours are up 22%. So we are up in double digits in terms of enrollment. So it's a pretty active place in the summertime.
That's right, cool, because there's a lot of summer offerings. Of course, you can always go to uas.alaska.edu, right? Is that the website?
Yes.
Yes, uas.alaska.edu,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
very
that's
good.
Just making sure that I have it right, because I went to UAA, so sometimes I slip up. So now I know that you had commencement happen. Tell us a little bit about what was going on with commencement.
Well, we had three amazing commencement ceremonies at each of our three campuses. We had one in Sitka, we had one in Ketchikan, and of course we had our commencement ceremony in Juneau. All three of them were fabulous, had some great student speakers and some other speakers as well. We were joined by our alumni and, of course, the family and friends of our graduates. And, you know, each one of them prominently featured our Alaska Native community.
And, awesome.
And, of course, here in Juneau, our Alaska Native community really opens graduation for us. It was incredibly inspiring and beautiful as always. We also had our Alaska Native graduation celebration to celebrate students outside of the regular graduation ceremony. Also an amazing and beautiful event.
That's wonderful. That's great. And so we mentioned that enrollment is up. We mentioned that commencement happened, which is cool. And then for those who have graduated, right, there's a special event that's happening like this Saturday, I think.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you mentioned that. So this Saturday is barbecue night for our alumni and friends. it is at the Noyes Pavilion, which is on our campus, the lakeside portion of our campus. And it's from 4 to 6 p.m. It's a chance for alumni to get together, for us to thank our alumni. I should note that our alumni helped immensely at graduation and have been playing a stronger and stronger role in the past few years as we are coming out of COVID in really helping our students and other alumni and the community succeed.
If there's people who have graduated from UAS, I guess you can also maybe just be a graduate of the UA system, I suppose. You could help out. But if they haven't been approached, usually the alumni associations are pretty good about targeting folks for membership. But if they haven't done that and you're a graduate, what should you do if you want to become involved in the Alumni Association?
So you can certainly call and visit our office. But I think one of the best things to do is to go to uas.alaska.edu/alumni.
Ah, okay.
And you can also sign up for our online alumni publication called Harbors, where alumni share their stories and how UAS made an impact in their lives. There you can get connected to some of our other events. Alumni can actually attend our networking events. So, you know, if alumni are looking for jobs out there or thinking about careers or thinking about changing careers, they can actually participate in our job fairs and in networking events so that they can get connected. Our alumni connect other alumni with positions all over Southeast Alaska and in Alaska. So
yeah, it's definitely a connection
place.
You want to make between the people who have gone there or have gone to the UA system in any way, shape, or form, because it's sort of stronger together, right?
Yes, and we are a family. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like even after you graduate from UAS, you're part of our family. Mm-hmm. You belong with us. You belong here.
Yeah, and I'm also glad that you mentioned that and summer enrollment is up. I'm assuming that, is that carrying over to enrollment throughout the year? Is it, because I know there was, I guess maybe 4 or 5 years ago, like enrollment was down, and I don't know exactly when it was, but enrollment was down, and it was a little tricky to get folks to stay or come and be part of the, because you have three campuses. So yeah. Like how you, what are the efforts that you're making to get people to be in Juneau or in Sitka or in Ketchikan to stay?
Well, first of all, I think we offer an amazing education. And because we're a small university, we offer kind of a personalized experience. Your mm-hmm. professor gets to know you. They get to know your name, what your story is. And because of that, I think we can offer a better experience for students, just that one-on-one experience. We also have like experiences that are just world-class. I can't think of too many other universities where you can work on glacier research that actually impacts communities across Alaska, and of course, this community in particular. Mm-hmm. You fly up in a helicopter with our researchers, you collect data, you work with them, you learn how to do science. That is phenomenal. Mm. One of our marine biologists just got a Fulbright fellowship, which will allow her to expand her research and travel all over the world. And you know, as she comes back, she brings those connections and that knowledge and those research opportunities to our students. So yeah. I think we do amazing things at UAS, and that's part of the reason why we actually have a good retention rate. Now, we are working to improve it, and as an open enrollment institution, what that means is that we are open to everyone, regardless of background, regardless of previous educational experiences. There's a pathway for everyone to be able to join UAS. For that type of institution where we get a wide variety of students, helping them stay at UAS so that they earn their degree is really important, and that's captured in a metric called retention or retention rate. And so over the past few years, we have made huge gains in our retention rate, especially since COVID. And of course, COVID was devastating.
Yeah.
But as we have had students come back and really reconnect with each of our campuses, we have grown in our ability to retain them, help them graduate, and actually help them stay in Alaska.
And I love that UAS also, is, if I recall this number being right, that the average age is a little bit older of a student, because there's a lot of adults who, because I think sometimes you think of college as, oh, you got to be in your 20s. And no, if you want to go back to school, there's all kinds of cool programs at UAS that you can check out, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the things that we're really proud of is that we have lots of different options. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a working adult, you can still pursue your education. And you're absolutely right about our demographics. We have a lot of students who are not the traditionally aged student. And, you know, when we have students of, you know, with a wide variety of ages, it adds to the richness of the classroom, whether it's an in-person class or whether it's an online class. You get, you know, all these different types of perspectives in the same classroom. So I'm really, really thankful that we can be a university that welcomes people from all ages, all backgrounds, and make them feel like they are contributing while we are helping them achieve the dream.
Yeah, and you can make sure you find out about classes. I guess, when are people needing to begin thinking about the fall? Is that already happening?
So fall classes are on the books.
They're on the books, okay.
But, you know, you can register to be a student all the way up until August.
Okay.
So classes don't begin until mid-August or so. And so we're still accepting applications if you are a new student. If you're a continuing student, we encourage you to go in and pick your classes now so that you have your seat saved for the fall.
Yeah.
So a lot of great things going on.
Got to get your seat saved for sure, because some of those classes, they do fill up. And then you're like, wait, I didn't want to go to class at 8:15, but now I have to because I didn't get the 10 o'clock or whatever it is. I remember that always making me mad because I waited too long to register for my classes. Other things going on that I didn't mention happening this summer? I want to make sure we get everything in.
Oh, I think think you mentioned quite a bit.
Okay. I do want to put another plug in for the alumni barbecue. It's this Saturday. And, of course, you can go to uas.alaska.edu/alumni, and I'm sure there's information there. I'm sure it's all over the Facebook page as well and all that kind of stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, of course, you also had some accolades recently. I saw something come across my email with the School of Education being recognized as one of 34 programs of excellence or something? Tell me about that.
Sure. You know, when you have a school of education and you are actively involved in preparing teachers, you are usually accredited by a national organization. Mm. And what accreditation is all about it's a way in which you are continuously meeting rigorous national standards for how you prepare teachers, what you do, the classes that you offer, the qualifications of your faculty, the qualifications of your staff. And so every accredited school of education has to go through a cycle of continuous accreditation. And we reached a point where we were at the end of the cycle, ready for the next continuation of our accreditation, and we received that accreditation. So our accreditation comes from the Council for the Accreditation of Educator Preparation, CAPE. And so we continue to be a CAPE-accredited school of education, which takes a lot of hard work and dedication.
Well, congratulations to the School of Education, because I know there's a lot of people that go and get their Masters of Teaching at UAS, and they're all throughout the system of our education here in Alaska. They go out to Dillingham, they go out to other places, and they become teachers. And so I love that we're sort of having that homegrown right here at UAS.
Yes, we are definitely a school that hosts a lot of students in Alaska, and we have both online and in-person programs so that we make it easy for people who really want to be a teacher or be an administrator at a school.
I love that. Dr. Aparna Palmer, Chancellor for the University of Alaska Southeast, my favorite polychaetes and tardigrades, marine biologists, because that is your background. Have you been able to pick up anything new in that arena recently?
You know, my job as a chancellor keeps me
pretty busy, right?
Busy. But I was thinking about you today.
You
and
were.
I know that you always ask about polychaetes and tardigrades, which are close to my heart. But I also want to tell you the onychophorans are out there.
The onychophorans. Okay. I'm going to have to look that up for next time. Onychophorans. How do you spell that?
O-N-Y-C-H-O-P-H-O-R-A-N-S.
I love it. Well, I'll have to do my research. You've given me homework. Dr. Aparna Palmer has given me homework, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you being on Juno Afternoon.
Thank you. Gunas Chish.
Gunas Chish. A little more Blackwater Railroad to close out the day.
Stranded, some need off by staying home. She likes a move towards the danger. There ain't nothing like getting lost by yourself with a stranger. Fresh tattoo of a lover's lies. Hiding the color of the night's disguise. Don't break stride in the blazing heat. Through the sounds of a crowded street, she says, I'm not scared. Don't ask twice. If you are my rock and roll.
That's going to do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, we preview the Cancer Connections National Cancer Survivors Day activities this coming Sunday. Plus, Blackwater Railroad Company stops in ahead of their performance at the Crystal Saloon on Friday night. Plus, it's rainy, but you can still get out and walk with the Juno Audubon Society every Saturday this June. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3. and KAUK Juno Akbe 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you and Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher. Good at cheese.
Live and local, KTOO 104.3 Juno and KAUK 91.7 Juno Auk Bay.